All right, welcome everybody. We are just a couple of days away from Shavuot. And of course, we will be reading the Megillah of Rut. And tonight's topic is we're going to go into the Megillah, get appreciation. There's so much there to glean. It's only four small, relatively small, full chapters, but it is an amazing story. And the title of the class is When Boaz Met Ruth. Okay, so we're going to start with a video as we do. So this is a video. Sharing about Masbia soup kitchens. This is already from about 10 years ago, but it was their new insight in which we'll talk about, and we'll take it from there, and then we'll apply it to our study of the second chapter of the book of Ruth. Here we go. Okay.
A restaurant with no cash register.
Thank you. It's very well balanced, and the soup is always delicious.
It's a perfect place to get food to the people.
A soup kitchen does not need to look like the way it comes to people's mind.
It makes you know that you're still in society. You know, just because you're going through some rough time, you're not the only one going through it.
What we're very focused on is how can we get the hungry to eat in a very dignified way? Most people see charity as something that has to take those people and get them out of where they are now. What we're saying is, can we be kind to them where they are now? And that warmth will go a long way helping them. That's my grandfather. He used to have a matzah factory in his backyard, which we, the day of the Seder, that afternoon we used to come the entire family and do the matzah baking together. At my grandmother's, every Saturday there was guests at the table, and usually guests that no one wanted to invite to their table. Those are the ones who I was sitting next to growing up. The odor was not so comfortable. A lot of what they were talking about wasn't so good and clean, but these are the people who she taught us to care for. The first night we opened up, only 8 people showed up. So we thought, okay, so the naysayers have it. We're trying something, but nobody really needs it. But after a few months, we were already doing 100 meals a night.
Satisfaction for me give healthy food, natural food. This is what the people need.
Our chef Ruben Diaz comes in that morning or a day before and sees what did we get from the local farmers market, what did we get donated from the local supermarket, and creates a menu around that.
The soup from today, all the potatoes is donated by City Harvest. We have to buy the carrots, the chicken, fresh squash. Well, my dream is open a restaurant. Not now. I have to save a lot of money, but I feel like this is my passion. Cook for the people, for the community.
All right, let's go to Queens.
You see, it's not even 3 o'clock, but the people are already by the corner.
It's pretty tough. Too many people.
Raising $2 million a year, if you divide that into days, it's very daunting. So it's not fair to say that's every day a pleasure when you know that tomorrow's the first and you don't have the money in the bank to pay the rent for the 3 locations. It's no picnic. But there's some sort of the immediate satisfaction that's always there, where people come in and they're hungry, they leave satiated. You go at the end of the year, you tally up the meals, and you see it's 500,000 meals, and you say, wow, okay, this is really making a difference in so many people's lives. That feeling is a very good feeling.
Perfect. Combination.
All right. All right. So at that point, this was 9 years ago. They were doing 500,000 meals a year. They're currently at 2 million meals a year in their three locations. They also added a pantry as well. So, all right, so let's get into it. Welcome, Chaim. Okay. Okay, so question number one, what element did Masbiya innovate in the world of soup kitchens? They had a chiddush, as they say in Hebrew. What was their chiddush?
They made it, well, they call it a restaurant without a cash register. So the idea is that instead of, or the way I would picture a soup kitchen is usually like people come and there's kind of like a line, like the school cafeteria, and they walk with their tray and they're handed food or poured out food. And here they come, they sit down at a table. They're, I believe, wait, it looks like they're waited on. There's a wait staff and they're given a certain dignity and a humanity by being treated that way.
Exactly. That was Alexander Rapoport's chiddush. That instead of having the traditional soup kitchen, which is basically a person might feel like an inmate at a penitentiary where you're sort of walking past this line of people and then people will put food on your tray and you're given a meal. Okay, well, it's good as you're getting a meal. It's better than starving. But here, they're treated with dignity. They come, they sit down, they're welcome, they're greeted. They're given scratch food made fresh every day. Not just that, but nutritious food, and they were able to participate. Now, so as Shana pointed out, and what it gives is a certain dignity, an extra measure of dignity for people who are obviously really struggling with food insecurity. It's a tremendous thing. Now, what do you notice? What do you notice now? The food, as a person who works for the OU. The Orthodox Union is the official hashkacha for the Masbiya kitchens and pantries. So therefore, any Jew who has will feel comfortable eating the food from a kosher standpoint. But what do you know about the policy about helping Jews and non-Jews?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Masha.
No, I was just gonna say it was cool to see. It's funny because I actually remember. I saw that place once, but I didn't really notice until now that it's everyone is welcome. And I also thought it was cool that I didn't really think much before about who works there, but the chef is not Jewish. And I think it's awesome that this is what the chef sees about the Jewish community.
Exactly. So both those items are true. Number one, the Talmud and the Rambam says, Befarnasim aniye Yisrael im aniye akum, that one provides food for the Jewish poor together with the non-Jewish poor. So if you're opening up a soup kitchen here, everybody's welcome. That's it, and therefore you'll have obviously they wanted to do the video shoot in not such an invasive way. They obviously asked permission for people, but I will tell you the three locations they are is in Borough Park, Flatbush, and Queens, which are densely populated populations of Jews. We have Julie was a volunteer. Okay, great. Maybe she'll share a little. Julie, can you share a particular story? Were you involved in the actual soup kitchen or the pantry? Can you share a little bit of your experience?
Sure. So I actually, I was in the kitchen and I was waiting on the individuals who sat down at the table. So it's very fulfilling. They walk in and they sit down and There's no questions asked. They may have to sign a book when they get there. I don't recall exactly. And it was. And then I went with friends, and in the kitchen we would be chopping or like whatever we were told. So it was. It was definitely a good opportunity. I don't recall, exactly the customers that I served who were there, but it was, I would say it's definitely something easy that you can do and also fulfilling.
And did you sense of like, was it mostly Jews or mostly non-Jews? What was your, when you went those times, what was the experience?
I'm not really sure, to be honest. Like, it was difficult to tell. Like, I mean, I didn't really, you don't really converse with them so much. You really just go ahead and give them the food, and everyone gets the same thing. And then they eat and then they leave. So I'm not really certain, to be honest.
Right. So anyway, but the key thing is that, as Julie said, just to highlight two things, everybody's welcome, both Jew and non-Jew, number one. Number two is they don't do any means tests. In other words, you don't have to bring documentation to prove that you were, in fact, in need. And that's that. So now one of the things that he mentioned, which I don't know if everybody caught, he said, Alexander Epport said, to help the poor in their world. Why is that significant? And what was the import of what he said?
I didn't quite understand that, actually. Like, how did he mean that?
Okay, so I want to unpack that because it was a little bit unclear. So let's, Shane, do you have a thought?
So he had said, the way I interpreted it, at least, it sounded like he was saying he's meeting people where they're at, as opposed to other organizations that try to raise them up from where they are. So it, at least that's how I was hearing it. So it's like, okay, there's a person who can't feed himself for dinner tonight. So or it's like the expression on, if you teach a man to fish, he'll be able to eat for forever, as opposed to like, if you give him a fish, he can only eat for now. So this, I think, was more about, this person needs help. They need a meal right now. So I'm going to help them right now, as opposed to helping them be able to feed themselves for longer. At least that's how I was.
Correct. And specifically helping them now, but where they live, in other words, not having them get on a subway and travel for great distances, nor they put their restaurants without cash registers in places where there are a lot of people who are living below the poverty line, or so they don't have to travel to uptown or downtown or wherever to get the basket of food or whatever it may be. He's coming to them. He's meeting them where they're at. And you're right. It's not, and that's what, you know, so we're going to get to that specifically. So he's solving a very immediate problem. Like, what am I going to do for dinner tonight? Not so far as the more broader issues, what other organizations deal with, of how do you help a person transition out of poverty? That's also important. But I'm just saying, he's dealing with the problem now. The person needs to eat dinner. Dinner is being served, period, full stop. Where are we doing it? Where the poor person will live, in the poorer neighborhoods of the five boroughs. It's not on the Upper East Side. It's not on the Upper West Side. It is in Borough Park with a lot of elderly people on fixed incomes. It is in Flatbush. Now, again, in New York, as we always have, for example, there's an organization which I've posted on the Halacha chat of Oneg Shabbos of the Upper West Side. They serve 100 families who live in the West Side. So they're living among the wealthiest people in the world, but they happen to be either in an apartment, which they're under a rent-controlled apartment or rent-stabilized, and they may have been out of work for a long period of time, and they're in distress. So it's a tremendous, just to echo what Masha posted, it is a big Kiddush Hashem. Here's a guy, clearly a discernible Jew, and his staff, many of them are not Jewish, serving Jews and non-Jews. And then just simply, that's it. You don't have to be a great philosopher. Clear. There's a need. Get the food. Done. Okay. So let's learn a little. We're gonna do a sort of a introductory. We're gonna learn some tzedakah basics. Brush up on our tzedakah basics. Then we're going to go into the second chapter. We're going to explore that. We'll fill in the gaps, obviously. And then we will put in some three practical scenarios that I encounter in my work in the community. And that will sort of like sensitize us to be more, take our tzedakah, shall we say, to the next level. So let's, without further ado, let's go to the sheet for a moment here. Okay. All right. Shema Vakasha, if you could read the seventh, this is from the seventh chatter of the Laws of Charity, Matnas Aniyim, Gift to the Poor. Good.
It is a positive commandment to give charity to the poor among the Jewish people, according to what is appropriate for the poor person, if this is within the financial capacity of the donor. As it states in Devarim, you shall certainly open your hand to him. I think Vayikra states, you shall support him, a stranger and a resident, and they shall live with you. And Vayikra also states, and your brother shall live with you.
Okay, so let's pause right there. So there's a positive commandment of the Torah that you're to give to the poor. So it's not just a nice thing, it's an obligation. To the poor within your the donor's financial capacity. It says, Patoach tiftach es yadcha, you shall surely open up your hand, and you vehechazaktebo, you'll support him, and you vehe achiche mach, and your brother will live with you. Now let's get into second paragraph.
Anyone who sees a poor person asking and turns his eyes away from him and does not give him charity transgresses a negative commandment, as it states in Devarim, do not harden your heart or close your hand against your brother, the poor person.
Ah, so if a poor Jew, now this one gets very complex, and he is asking, one who sees a, no, it's not even going to be asking, but he's asking for tzedakah, and you would turn your eye, you don't give, it's a violation of a Torah prohibition. Do not harden your heart or close your hand against your brother, the poor person. Now notice, on the technical halachic level, this prohibition applies to Jews. So therefore, if you are, let's say there was an authentic, truly a poor person panhandling on the streets of Manhattan, which of course happens all the time, a person would not violate a Torah prohibition. Now, should the person give on an ethical, philosophical level, one should. I don't have to give a, now, we're now leave something, okay? We discuss this on other classes, but we're halacha is first the floor. So the floor is you first focus on your halachic brother and sister, your fellow Jew, and then you go to the rest of the citizens of the world. All right, number three, let's keep on going.
We have a question.
Yeah, sorry, Julie.
How does that work, like on the subway, if people ask you for money, or on the stairs going to the hotel?
So in Israel or in America?
Subway in America and stairs at the hotel.
Okay, great. So a couple things. That could be a little sheer in its own right, but I'll sort of give you the sort of the quick answer. So from the technical halachic level for non-Jews, you would not be in any violation. Certainly it's a positive thing to give. Now, again, it gets into the issue of the question that we have to define is the poor. Well, is a person really poor? Now, you can research that. So certainly, I try whenever possible, if I, you know, to give a person a quarter, you know, a couple, you know, whatever, change, even though they're not Jewish, because that's certainly a mita tova of being a generous person and helping a person in need. In Israel, as you pointed out, gets more complex. And there's a lot of literature on this, because in the Kotel, I know you're going to be shocked that there are people who are professional tzedakah collectors who are actually not poor. Okay? In other words, they're collecting every day. Either they're a little bit crazy, they're a little bit off, they're more very off, or B, they are not an Ian, because they're basically making 1,000 shekels a day, $300 a day. They're not technically an Ian. An Ian means you have to hit it. There's a poverty test, okay, which they would fail. In other words, they're not poor. Ah, But I don't, I, my attitudes personally, I don't want to get, you know, maybe at the Kotel where it's like there's a known scammers. Okay. I would say like this, there are many halakhic authorities that's investigated. Says if you don't give to these people, you've not violated them because these people are not actually poor. I'm talking about the regulars. Okay. You know, again, when in doubt, so you give a shekel, that's 25 cents. You won't, you know, you're not going to be, that won't. Therefore, you will fill the mitzvah minimally, and B, you won't violate the process. So I would always give a shekel because I don't want to violate the obligation just in case. Because not why would I let me spend a quarter and avoid the possibility of, you know, A, the opportunity of fulfilling a mitzvah if they are in fact poor, and B, avoiding a prohibition if they're not. So the best sort of workaround is giving a shekel. I would not say, again, since it's sort of the epicenter for scammers, Rabbi Aviner, who Posek, very popular Posek, says you would not be obligated to, because they already have there's an assumption that these people there are in fact not poor and are taking advantage of that all the tourists of the world, typically wealthy or wealthy-ish, are there, and they sort of feed on them. Give you a classic story. I went to the Kotel during the week, Daven Mincha, and I just look like, I'm just, my whole, everything about me is like screaming, American, American. When I was Davening Amidah, there was a circle of Aniyim, or people, I don't call them Aniyim, collectors, standing behind me, waiting for me to do an Oseh Shalom back. And when I did, they were like, you know, as they say in Yiddish, they were all over me. So, okay. So, like, are all of them scammers? Those who've done investigations said they're largely that case, but that's it. But there are a lot, unfortunately, there are plenty of poor people in Israel. I don't know, 10%, 20%. But we're going to get into that. So that's the short answer of your complex question. Okay. I keep on going. Number three.
We are commanded to give a poor person according to what he lacks. If he lacks clothes, we should clothe him. If he lacks household utensils, we should purchase them for him. If he is unmarried, we should help him marry. And for an unmarried woman, we should find a husband for her.
Okay. Notice he didn't say cash. What really is the mitzvah? What's the mitzvah tzedakah in its ideal form?
To give the person exactly what he or she needs.
Exactly. If it's food, you give them food. If it's clothing, it's clothing. If they need stuff for their house, utensils, you give them utensils. And even getting them a shidduch, or either getting them a shidduch, or what they call hachnas akala, helping paying for the wedding, which, you know, can be very quite pricey, or giving them money to set themselves up. It's not so simple, you know. So that's the mitzvah. It's not, many people giving tzedakah is, giving the poor person a dollar. Okay, that can be tzedakah, but really, it's really giving him to what he or she lacks. Okay? It's about an act of restoration. Now, again, if that person is going to many people, you don't have to be the chief or only restorer, but it's about restoring the person, as it says, and your brother shall live with you. In other words, you're bringing them back into the situation. So, we'll get to some details, but a classic situation. You have a friend who's very shy and they lost their job and they're having difficulty paying their rent. Help them pay their rent. That's what they need. That would be the mitzvah tzedakah. That's it. It's not only giving to an organization that is a very efficient distributor of the needs of the people. Those are great institutions, but we still have to do tzedakah, you know, direct practice. Let's keep on going. One more halacha, and we'll take into the Mishnah, into the Perek. Dead.
There are 8 levels in charity, each level surpassing the other. The highest level beyond which there is none is a person who supports a Jew who has fallen into poverty by giving him a present or a loan, entering into partnership with him, or finding him work so that his hand will be fortified so that he will not have to ask others for alms. Concerning this, Vayikra states, "You shall support him, the stranger, the resident, and he shall live among you." Implied is that you should support him before he falls and becomes needy.
This is very critical. So I think people are familiar with this. The Ram has the famous 8 levels of charity. And the number one level is to basically preemptively and with great dignity help the person out so they won't become a poor person. So how do you, so the person needs a loan to start a business or to make an investment or whatever like that, or to help them, you know, it's a gap between one paycheck and another paycheck. That's the highest level of tzedakah. Or bring him into the business, give him a job, get him a job, helping him find him work. I mean, one thing that everybody here knows, raise your hand if you know Steve Eisenberg. Okay, everybody, Steve Eisenberg is an amazing person. Of course, he, of course, still is involved. Well, he used to be called in, we used to have, he'd be in the Jewish Center with we call it Jikni, the Jewish Internationals of New York City, whatever. He ran that, Jody Samuels, still does. He's out of Florida now. One of the things he did, like on the side, like in addition to giving classes and creating Friday night dinners for international people who are alone, whether it be now and, you know, before New York and then now in Florida, was he had a massive network. And he got, it's got to be hundreds of people jobs. That is the highest form of tzedakah. Now, the person wasn't about having to go to the Masbiya soup kitchen. They didn't need a dinner that night, but they're in a bad situation. When you're like between jobs, that's a very scary place, or you're suffering and you're in a terrible job. A guy gets you a job, or, you know, at least in this case, an interview, and you're able to get the job. That is huge. And he's just a one person that is just, you know, just gifted at that. So I just wanted to give him a public shout out because he's done this mitzvah for decades in, I would say, in the most amazing way. So that's a great example. All right, so let's get into the So this goes into something that was referenced, I think Shana referenced before. According to the laws of tzedakah, what does Masbiya excel in and what aspect of tzedakah is not addressed? Where does the Masbiya soup kitchen excel in tzedakah? And what aspect of tzedakah is not addressed at all?
I mean, they give people what they need in, like, they fulfill an immediate need for food, but I guess they don't, I don't know, they don't get them work or get them, like, long-term financial aid.
Correct. They're not dealing with, they're not able to help the guy, because mitzvah is the hechazakta, you strengthen the person. So the person will be able to be empowered to leave the state of poverty. They're solving the problem right now. What's the problem? It's 7 o'clock. I have no dinner and I don't have any money to pay for it. Solution? Must be a soup kitchen, dinner. A lot of kosher food right now, boom, and it'll be, you know, made by the chef there, and you got a dinner. And that's not solving your problem tomorrow because you have the same problem. Okay, so how does one navigate that? Well, that's, and there are many organizations that help people with that as well. You know, the Met Council for Poverty. There are many organizations that both here in Israel that deal with that. But it doesn't have to be done through institutional vehicles only. And now let's get to that. With all these background, with this sort of this halachic prism to see things, and also the Masbiya soup kitchen, let us get into the Shavua state of mind with the Megillah. Is anybody else able to read? I don't know, because I can't see if you're able to see. Anybody else want to read other than Shana?
Sure.
Ed, Mashallah.
Okay, Naomi had a kinsman on her husband's side, a man of substance of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, I would like to go to the fields and glean among the ears of grain behind someone who may show me kindness. Yes, daughter, go, she replied, and off she went. Should I just read the whole paragraph? Or?
Yeah, read the paragraph and we'll take a pause right here.
Yeah. Okay. She came and gleaned in a field behind the reapers, and as luck would have it, it was the piece of land belonging to Boaz, who was of Elimelech's family. Presently, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem. He greeted the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they responded, "The Lord bless you." Boaz said to the servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose girl is that?" The servant in charge of the reapers replied, "She is a Moabite girl who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab."
Okay, so as you guys are familiar, we hear the famous story. There's Naomi. She's married to Elimelech, and they have two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Apparently they were distinguished people. We've given a shear on the first chapter of why they left, and then he dies, Elimelech dies, then their two sons dies, leaving Naomi with two daughter-in-laws, Ruth, and Orpah. Orpah, with Naomi's encouragement, ends up going back to Moab, to the fields of Moab. Moab, by the way, is very close. It's basically in modern-day Jordan. It's not that far away. And Ruth, in her famous declaration, "Your people, my people, wherever you go, I will go," wherever, you know, et cetera, the famous gesture of conversion, a whole interesting debate we've discussed in other classes. When did Ruth convert? Whatever. But right now, they're alone, but they have no husbands, so they're obviously in a dire situation. They're obviously back in the ancestral land in Beit Lechem, which, though we've been to, it's about 5 miles south of Jerusalem. And basically, and Ruth saying, like, you know, it, you know, the kitchen, the refrigerator is going to be empty pretty darn soon, so we got to get on this. So she asked her mother-in-law, who's obviously older, can I go and do what, you know, gathering leket? Those people who went with me one summer, we did a couple summers. I think maybe even Masha, you may have been. Maybe, I don't know if you guys, did you guys, when we went and picked in the field for leket?
No, not me.
Julie, did you do that with us? All right. We did a couple times. I know Sybil was in that year. If you were in Sybil's class, we did that. And Evan Hershenson. Anyway, so those we went, and they, leket means to pick up the gleaning. So there's an organization that does that, where they'll have people volunteer and pick donated fields, and the food is gathered, like we picked onions, and then it goes to soup kitchens across Israel to help the poor. A beautiful thing. Anyways, so she shows up, and as her circumstance would thing it, she ends up in the field of Boaz. Boaz is a relative of Elimelech, her old father-in-law. Okay. And she shows up. Okay. Masha, keep on going. You're doing great.
She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the reapers." She had been on her feet ever since she came this morning. She has rested but little in the hut. Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen to me, daughter. Don't go glean in another field. Don't go elsewhere, but stay here close to my girls. Keep your eyes on the field. They are reaping, and follow them. I have ordered the men not to molest you."
All right, so that's a bad translation for modern.
I know. I figure that's not literal. I can't talk.
I would say the word "bother you." Okay.
Right.
The word "molest" cannot be on any translation anymore. Like, better. Going.
Yeah, when you are thirsty, go to the jars and drink some of the water that the men have drawn. She prostrated herself with her face to the ground and said to him, "Why are you so kind as to single me out when I'm a foreigner?" And Boaz said, "I have been told of all that you did for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother in the land of your birth and came to a people you had not known before. May the Lord reward your deeds. May you have a full recompense from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have sought refuge." And she answered, "You are most kind, my Lord, to comfort me and to speak gently to your maidservant, though I am not so much as one of your maidservants."
Okay, so now they have an interesting interchange. So she shows up randomly, ends up in the field. She asked to do the gleaning. Everybody, the basic halacha is like this. Part of the many safety nets that they have in Jewish law is, of course, you can't. There's peah, which is that you're not allowed to harvest all the corners of the field. You have to leave it for the poor. And when you're doing harvesting of the various grains, barley and wheat, if one or two sheaves of individual stalks of grain fall to the ground, you can't pick them up. And you got to leave them for the people who are going to do gleaning afterwards. That's the poor. Okay. And basically, so Boaz, and they said, yes, sir. And Boaz says, don't worry, don't go anyplace else. Nobody's going to bother you. Because obviously she looked, obviously as a foreigner, she looked discernibly not Jewish, apparently. It's funny. The question that is odd, which I don't have a great answer for. I'll just tell you straight out, is that even if she at this point seems to have converted, why do they keep on calling her Ruth the Moabite? She should be Ruth the convert. So I don't know why she gets labeled like that. So I'm not sure about that. And then he says, I'm being so kind because I heard what you did, and you did for your mother-in-law Naomi, and you, at the death of your husband, you left, and then basically. He depicts her great journey of leaving her community where she had tremendous security to an unknown circumstance with an elderly widow. And may Hashem reward you. And she says, all right. And he says, and she's very humble about everything. Okay, let's keep on going. Masha, keep on going. We'll finish it off.
Sure. So at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come over here and partake of the meal and dip your morsel in the vinegar. So she sat down beside the reapers. He handed her her roasted grain, and she ate her fill and had some left over. When she got up again to glean, Boaz gave orders to his workers. You're not only to let her glean among the sheaves without interference, but you must also pull some stalks out of the heaps and leave them for her to glean and not scold her. She gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned. It was about an ephah of barley, and carried it back with her to the town. When her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and when she also took out and gave her what she had left over after eating her fill, her mother-in-law asked her, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be he who took such generous notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law, whom she had worked with, saying, the name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz. Naomi said to her mother-in-law, blessed be he, O the Lord of the Lord, who has not failed in his kindness to the living or to the dead. Naomi explained to her daughter-in-law, the man is related to us. He is one of our redeeming kinsmen. Ruth the Moabite said, he even told me, stay close by my workers until all my harvest is finished. And Naomi answered her daughter-in-law, Ruth, it is best, daughter, that you go out with his girls and not be annoyed in some other field. So she stayed close to the maidservants of Boaz and gleaned until the barley harvest and the wheat harvest were finished. Then she stayed at home with her mother-in-law.
Okay, so basically what's going on here, just to know what the, in Israel, the barley comes to, the barley comes into, is ripened, sort of like what we call April and May, and then June, July is the wheat harvest. So basically she stayed in his fields for about 4 months, and basically she was gathering, and then, she would, after gathering all the wheat, she would, turn it into grain to turn into flour. And now he's referring to, does anybody know what he's, Naomi says, he's one of our redeeming kinsmen, redeeming relatives. Does anybody know what that means?
It's because he was obligated to marry her, I think. Like it's like a certain relative.
So he does end up marrying her. That's in the next chapter. But it means something very specific, and it's not rub. It's connected really to Naomi. What really is? What is it? What is what the Goel, the Redeemer, is a person. If another instrument of the safety net is when a person. Your last, everybody in the Jewish people are given an ancestral land. If you get really desperate, you can sell it, but typically the person who should be buying it first is basically your relative. So the land will stay in the general family, and you will get financial help. Okay. That's the, so basically, and there's an order based upon lineage, who should do it. We'll, in the next chapter, you're going to see that there's going to be another person called Ploni Almoni, which is the Navi's way of saying, you know, John Smith. They don't mention him, which of course is interesting. Once the guy, and he was willing to do just the financial part, but what Boaz added to the package, which apparently was his own little insight, was in addition to redeeming the old field, there's also marrying Ruth. Okay. Which is interesting that there's not a Yibum, there's not a Levirate marriage here, because there's no, you know, if brother one dies childless, then the younger brother would marry the widow. That's not here, but it's happening. That's happening a little later. But let's deconstruct this chapter. So let me ask you a couple basic questions. What is impressive about Ruth's initiative?
She says she's going to follow her mother-in-law when the other, I think it's two sisters.
Her sister-in-law.
Oh, her sister-in-law said that she wouldn't.
Right. So that's the one. But in this particular chapter, what initiative did she show here when they start to have food insecurity?
I mean, she volunteers to go and do that.
But what is it? What is she doing? Let's break it. Let's fully understand the scope of what she's doing here.
Well, she goes to where they leave the field fallow, right, for the poor.
Well, you don't feel no. When they're doing the harvesting, there would be the poor that would be right behind all the harvester. In other words, the harvester would use a sickle. They would cut the various stalks of wheat or barley. They would gather them. Whatever fell to the ground, they'd have to leave for the poor. The poor would be behind them, and then they would pick it up. So Ruth is basically on her feet in the hot, you know, Israeli sun all day, okay, from literally morning until night. Her mother is not solving the problem because she's apparently too old, or it's beneath her dignity, or whatever reason she's not helping out. And basically, she goes out there and avails herself to all the gleanings, all the leket, and she goes through not one harvest, but the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. But this woman is, you know, we're talking back-breaking work over here. I mean, to go out in the field and pick up individual leftover stalks of wheat and barley, and then gather them, and then beat them, and then winnow them, and then you know mill them, and then turn them into you know wheat and flour, and then whatever they would use to make bread, and then they would maybe sell the rest to bring some money, income. That was extremely hard labor. That was, she basically had to work as a harvester essentially for 4 months. Now, what were the two reasons that, what reasons did Boaz give for being extra generous to her? First of all, how was he going beyond the letter of the law with her? There's a couple things he did.
He invited her to eat with them.
Right. So during the middle day, they had the worker meal. She joined the worker's meal every day for 4 months. Number one. What else? What else did he do? What else did he tell his staff to do secretly?
Oh, like to not bother her if she was going to go and pick up the stalks that were left over or something like that?
Well, picking up the stalks left over is once those stalks hit the ground, if they're one or two, that's not no longer the owner, does not belong to the owner of the field. That's the obligation of Leket, and that is for the poor. But he went above and beyond that. Anybody know what he did above and beyond that? I will highlight that.
He told them to drop extra.
There you go. Covertly drop extra. So therefore, not only would she gather the basic amount, she would gather a robust amount. That's why when she came home and she and Naomi saw what she had gathered, it was like, you know, what? It was like shocking. Okay. I don't know what she came home with, like, this, you know, I don't know, 20 pound bag of grain that she somehow was able to gather and mill down to a humongous amount of stuff. So she was shocked. So that was Boaz's generosity. Number one, that she should hang out and feel comfortable there. Number one. Number two, she can join, you know, take a rest in the apparently they had a hut there where people can get out of the sun, drink the water, have the lunch there. And as Sheena pointed out, told her workers to drop extra grain, extra stuff, so she would pick it up. So she would get a lot. She would come on with a humongous amount of stuff. Okay, great. Why was he so generous to her? He gives reasons.
One reason he says is because he heard how, or of what she did for Naomi.
Yes. One is, I told you all you've done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband, how you left your father and your mother. So the one thing is that because you did this tremendous chesed of accompanying your mother-in-law, where she could have had the good life. She could have stayed, according to the Midrash, interestingly, Ruth was an aristocrat. She was a princess. She was an aristocrat. She just wasn't a person. But still, she could have had the good life. She could have gone back to a good existence living among her people in Moab. Okay. What he gives another reason. He says, may you have a full recompense from the God, Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have sought refuge. What other reason is he being motivated to help her out?
Like that she should be rewarded? But is it crazy that if we say that maybe he just also liked her?
He doesn't say that in the text. And in fact, the third next chapter is that he's hoping that the other redeemer will, A, buy the field from Naomi, and he will marry Ruth. He doesn't want to do it. But he doesn't want to do that. So it's not like he was, you know, caught by by her immense beauty, and it was, suddenly it's a rom-com, you know, there's, you know, love in the field. No, it's not a love in the field situation. He says, because you feel rewarded from the Hashem, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have sought refuge. Basically, he is giving her extra because this is a woman, what they call a ger tzedek, georet tzedek. She is a righteous, the most righteous convert. In other words, basically, she left everything to basically live poor. This is, and especially, if you take the plain shot, I mean, we assume that Machlon Achilion, Elimelech's children, they were an aristocratic family. So obviously, who are they going to marry? A fellow aristocratic family. As you know, if you look in life, rich always marries rich, by and large. If you notice in life, rich people, why? Because they hang out, they're in the clubs and the vacations, whatever. Rich marries rich. So if she's hanging out, if they were a wealthy family, no doubt that they were not hanging out with the poor of Moab. They're hanging out with the machers of Moab. So Ruth is coming from a macher family. So she gave that all up because of her appreciation of what Judaism was as she saw it through her mother-in-law, Naomi. So he basically rewards her because of that. That is, now, a couple of principles that we get from this, we're going to, a little bit the practical. So Masha, if you, back to Shayna. Julie, can you read? Are you in a good, are you a place where you can read? All right, we're going to go to Shayna. Shayna and Great Neck. Let's do it.
The Ralbag's third benefit of this chapter. This chapter teaches that it is appropriate for a person to be assertive in seeking their needs, and when the opportunity presents itself, they should not be lazy in acquiring their needs. we see that Ruth, due to her industriousness, was able to support both her and her mother-in-law by gleaning all the leket, fallen gleanings, from morning until night.
Right. Ruth, this is amazing. In other words, could you imagine the feelings of resentfulness that Ruth could have had to her mother-in-law? You schlep me here to Beit Lechem, and we don't got a proverbial pot to piss in, and now I got to go out in the Schwitz every darn day and gather all the leket. But she did it, and she seems to be grateful for it, and she was the sole breadwinner for the family because all the men in their family died. So she saw the opportunity, she seized on it, and she was successful. Bottom line is, opportunities come in our lives. And part of what the Rabbah says we can learn from Ruth's example is that when the opportunity comes, and this is certainly in for our material well-being, you got to be open to the opportunity. And when the opportunity shows up, you got to get on it. You got to double down. You got to be energetic. You got to be assertive, because opportunities come, opportunities go. Ruth saw an opportunity. She went in it, and she worked hard, and she's able to support the family, her and her mom, mother-in-law, just by gathering the gleanings. Okay. Another one is this is also important. This gets toward more tzedakah part. I didn't get a chance to write out the translation. I'll just translate it myself right now. The 10th benefit is to inform us that it's appropriate to give chesed, to be kind to those who've done chesed to you, or to your relatives. So anybody who's done good to you, I mean, it's basically hakar sato. Anybody who's done good to you or to your relative, you should be, it's basically what they call in Yiddish, basic menschlichkeit. You should help them out. You see that because of the chesed that Ruth did to Naomi, that she was a relative, and she, all the kindness that Ruth had done on her behalf was mentioned in the Megillah. And she also, that she went out, or she wanted to prevent her mother-in-law, who left Beit Lechem as a part of the arist, you know, they didn't know. You can ask a question: well, why didn't Naomi go door to door to ask for tzedakah? Obviously, what was she? She was embarrassed. How did Ruth help her out? She went out, she went and gathered the gleanings. And that's why Boaz gave from the existing stocks. Because of all the chesed that Ruth had done for Naomi. And you saw that, and second is because he saw of the goodness of her heart that she had come to convert and be, as protected by the Kanfei Hashchina, the wings of the divine providence. And that's why he did kindness to Ruth and Naomi. And that's why Naomi wanted Ruth to work it out. That's why that's foreshadowing to the next chapter where Naomi suggests to go into the whole granary and to basically suggest in the mind of Boaz that they should get married. Okay. Now let's get to scenarios. Let me bring this back from just to review. We did 4 halachot about the basics of tzedakah, including the highest level tzedakah. We did the second chapter of Ruth, where we saw Boaz doing tzedakah in an exemplary fashion. Now let's get to our practical cases. Scenario number one: Steve MGR's sister is Ruth. Ruth had a difficult divorce and a custody battle, and arguments concerning the paying of alimony and child support seemed endless. What is Steve's tzedakah obligation?
I mean, maybe if he can, he could pick up where the child support leaves off.
Yeah. He's got to help her out. It's not, and by the way, I want to clarify, is tzedakah like a nice thing to do? I mean, it's certainly
it's a nice thing to do, but I think what you're getting at is that it's an obligation rather than like something you do because you feel like it.
Exactly. Exactly. Steve, because basically who is obligated goes in level of concentric circles from the poor person. Who has to help out the poor person first? The family. who's next? The community where the person lives in. You know what I'm saying? It goes in other words, he really has to be, what was Boaz? Ultimately, he was the Goel. He was the Redeemer. So Steve has got to help out his sister. Most people now, I deal with people who are in unfortunate circumstances. Ruth, how does a regular person, when I'm talking about personal psychological issues, fall into a bad financial situation? One classic way is the divorced woman. That person is oftentimes very vulnerable. She'll have a kid or two, or three, or four, whatever it may be. And then there's a divorce, and it's acrimonious. And then the husband, who may be the larger bread earner, will then weaponize the divorce or the arguments about child support, etc., and use it as a way to get what he wants. Okay. Often that will work out, and then that will oftentimes require more lawyers, which of course will bleed both parties dry. And then you can have a very situation where a woman could be in a bad financial situation, really bad. Okay, I know many such cases. So the family's got to step up. That's step one. Then the next community. That's what, you know, when typically all rabbis have a, you know, all synagogue rabbis have a rabbi discretionary fund. And these are the type of people the rabbi will help Ruth. She's having a problem covering a payment, whatever it may be. Most commonly the issue is yeshiva tuition, because that's a very expensive line item in the old budget. Help it out, work it out, help with the yeshiva, work out some deal, etc. So Ruth, Steve, what I'm trying to think, he has to be the goel to his sister. It's not a nice thing to do. It's a mitzvah from the Torah, and it's a prohibition not to do it, to hide your eyes. I don't see any problems. She's your sister. You got to do it. That's step one. Okay, so that's a very, I'm just giving you modern day applications, how tzedakah will present itself. Next, Nancy MGR's brother Roth received a bad review and is deeply afraid of getting laid off. Roth is devastated and is not so functional. What is Nancy's tzedakah obligation? Just to give you, basically, Roth is, he's like sitting on the couch. He's like out of it. What does Nancy got to do? What's the tzedakah obligation?
I mean, maybe just be there for him, like talk to him, because he's not necessarily losing his job.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So tzedakah, but you saw from the Rambam, he says we'll go back up. Implied is that you should support him before he falls and becomes needy. That's the highest level tzedakah. So if Nancy sees that her brother's like falling apart, he's like, you know, becoming depressed and morose, and what's going to happen then? How is he going to do on the job if he's feeling completely bummed out and down? It might cascade down that he will actually might get fired. So she has to figure out. And now is it only on her? Is it only on Nancy? What should Nancy do? What are some strategies that Nancy should employ? What do you guys think? What can Nancy do?
I mean, she could recruit other people in the family to help, maybe, but we don't know his situation, I guess, so.
Right, but that's exactly because, you know, as they say, it takes a village. In other words, it's not, if Ross is down, maybe she just, you know, she should call Ross's friends. You know, Ross calls her, you know, Stan, you know, because many times when people get into financial difficulties, their natural impetus is to keep it quiet. I don't want anybody to know. They're embarrassed. So she's got on the DL, protect his dignity. Stan, Ross going through a difficult time. He's feeling very low. He's nervous to get laid off. He needs some chizuk. He needs some encouragement. Take him out. Show him a good time. Encourage him. Maybe if there's an issue, maybe there's another person that they know that could be a good life coach who could be provide some guidance, pick up another skill. Maybe if the situation is concerning, maybe start networking for perhaps another job. help the guy up before he falls. Because if he falls, then it's like all the way down. Then it's a disaster. Yeah, exactly. Recruit friends and family to help Ross out before. That's the mitzvah. That's the mitzvah tzedaka. Let's keep on going. Miriam's sister, Julia, wants to start a small business. She needs startup capital. Julia's smart, lacks much business experience and will not likely get a conventional loan. Miriam knows that if this business collapses, Julia will be devastated. What is Miriam's tzedaka obligation?
Ask her for a business plan.
Business plan one. What else?
I mean, it depends on what the means that Miriam has, or if she knows people who would be like, once I forgot the other person's name, but once she like gets educated on what she needs to do, maybe there are people that she knows that could like be investors and feel like they would get a return on it.
Good. So one thing is to gather investors to help out. If she has the means, give her some of the money. I want to give you a loan. I want, you know, Julia, you know, you got a great idea. You're very creative. I believe in you. It's a mitzvah to give giving loans. And that's why we don't charge interest for personal loans. It's a form of tzedakah. It's tzedakah with dignity. Here's the money. Invest the money. Invest in your business. Be a success. And that's it. If you can't do it yourself, as Masha says, well, maybe you know somebody who can invest or pull some investors together who allow Julia to present her plan. And then what Julia says, well, I think you'll get a loan better if you have a professional, written, articulated business plan, which you can show to investors and get them excited about your vision and your project. Exactly. So the bottom line is, in other words, the person does not yet have, this person is not yet at the masbia level where they do not know where the food's coming. But the mitzvah is not only to respond to the person in need, but to anticipate the person starting to fall and be there and catch them and support them and lift them. And you see that Boaz did that to Ruth. And no, he didn't just give him a handout. He did it covertly. He allowed her to gather the stuff. He allowed her to work for the food. He felt that would be the more dignified way. He just stripped an extra stuff. So she just got very successfully. And this way, he was able to support the family based upon the yield that she gathered in those couple of months out of his various fields in that area. So I wanted to sort of sensitize tzedakah. We always assume is like, you know, helping out the homeless person with a thing. That's a form of tzedakah. But the more tzedakah essentially is restoring the person, giving them, what they need. It's not only cash. It's, food, clothing, shelter, shidduch, whatever it may be. Help them out, and also B, to anticipate the problem and be there before they fall. If they're starting to slip, catch them. And who's obligated? From, the closest family member down. And that's the mitzvah. And we see that Boaz, who was not the first guy line of defense, the redeemer, ultimately toward the end of the story, ultimately is a redeemer. They get married. They have a child. And that from that child, come from that union, from that marriage, comes King David. So from tzedakah to the Melech HaMashiach is the story of the Book of Ruth. Any questions? All right. Thank you so much, everyone. Have a great night. Thanks for joining. It's good to see you, to learn with you guys. And I want to wish everybody a Chag Sameach, a wonderful Matan Torah, a time of reaccepting the Torah at Shavuos. And of course, when you find time, enjoy a slice of cheesecake because it is delicious. All right, everyone. Have a good night.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
All the best. Bye.
Rabbi.
Yes.
You can stop.